Good morning and welcome to Perspectives. I'm your host, Reverend Kelvin Lumpkin, and today we've got a great show in store for you. Joining us on the show is the Vice Mayor of Sarasota, Florida, District 3 Commissioner Kelly Kirshner, and joining us a little later in the show in the second half, Mr. Eric Robinson, who is a former chairman of the Republican Party of Sarasota, political commentator and political consultant. You're listening to 96.5 WSLR LPFM, Sarasota, Florida. Commissioner Kirshner, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you, Calvin, for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here with you.
Well, first, before we get down to the business of the city, first, I just want to commend you for the great work that you do for our city and how well you serve our city. And you're actually living up to the political legacy that's been handed to you. And I don't know if most of our listeners know this, but your father actually was a former commissioner and former mayor of Sarasota.
That's correct, and yeah, I don't know if I'm living up to it, because even when I came into the station this morning, they greeted me as "Hello, Kerry." So that happens at least three times a day still. So hopefully, a couple more years, and I might be able to to craft out my own identity in the community too. But no, I'm happy to follow in the footsteps of my dad, who obviously his name's Kerry. He served two terms on the city commission, and it's great that he's still in town, and I was joking with someone the other day. It feels a lot like JV or varsity basketball in high school, where dad's still on the sidelines, can talk to him at halftime and see if he has any thoughts on the game.
Yeah. Well, even though you're following his footsteps in some ways, it's clear to me that you're blazing your own trail. And what exactly compelled you to run for city commission?
There were a few particular issues probably about a year before the last election. I had become the president of my neighborhood association, and prior to that, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Guatemala working on municipal development. I actually worked in a city hall, and so I tell a lot of people, despite my father's background, I think I got more of the political bug working in Guatemala in a city hall than I did growing up with my dad in city hall. But one of the frustrating things in Guatemala was, and it was a legacy of their 36-year civil war, was nobody wanted to get active in civil society. And the reason was is kind of the Chuck E. Cheese hedgehog game, where if you pop your head up, particularly during their civil war, as someone who wanted to get active in local politics, you were seen as a possible threat. And frequently those people were targeted and killed or disappeared. And that legacy still exists, that outside of, you know, being a member of a church, most people, a choral club like a Key Club or anything social doesn't really exist, particularly in most cities outside of the capital city. And so, seeing that and seeing how that really contributed to a very dysfunctional local government in Guatemala, I really appreciate the fact how we have such strong choral associations, starting at your basic neighborhood association. So when I came back home and I got the first postcard saying you're having a neighborhood association meeting this week, it's kind of just this reaffirmation that you really love and appreciate where you live and where you grow up, that you have these types of things that all integrate in hopefully the functioning of a good community. So it was very easy for me after that to get involved with the neighborhood association. This was during the heady days of our construction boom, where, a lot of people now say selfishness turned to greed, and people were saying, we're going to roll out this next project, we're going to do this next condo project and have pre-sales, and we'll sell them out in a few hours. And I think all of you and listeners can remember those days. And we had a particular project that came and was requesting a change to our comprehensive plan to allow them to build to downtown core zoning, literally within 30 feet of property lines of, 1950s bungalow houses in our neighborhood. And despite the fact that the planning board unanimously voted against it, it went to the city commission. There were very significant changes to the item, I think literally 2 hours before the vote, and the city commission, still voted for it. And it kind of was one of those things, not just for our neighborhood, but throughout the community, where people said, enough is enough, and we want to retain some of the character and identity of our community, have better conversations, make better decisions. And so that's really what pushed me to do it. And ironically, I think everybody recognizes that at that point when I ran for office, that the winds were already changing in our economy throughout the world in terms of that speculative market, and which I'm more than happy with, because happy that I'm not necessarily, that we're not having those conversations anymore, because I think we're back to conversations, true conversations about our community, because I've talked to a number of people. You know, that was the gold rush of our area. I don't think we're going to see that for another century. That type of, you know, number one, the speculative market, but obviously the increases in property values and everything else that I think had a lot of, you know, deleterious effects on our community in terms of lack of affordable housing.
That's an interesting statement you made, and let me interject here. You and I have in common that we're both lifelong residents of Sarasota. So over our lifetimes, we've seen, I'm a little bit older than you, we've seen it change and evolve so much over the years. We've seen incredible growth.
Right.
Over our lifetimes, do you think Sarasota is growing at the right pace, or if I'm understanding you correctly, was that your concern, that we were not growing at the right pace?
Out of control growth is a cancer, and I think everybody agrees that there was never a market there. It was all speculation. I think where we are now, there is no growth, and that's unfortunate too. And I think hopefully we're taking this moment in a global financial crisis as a community to reflect on, you know, what happened during that last boom, and what are the types of things that we can do as a community, number one, to move us out of that traditional boom-bust cycle that is so dependent on construction and bringing in Yankees to buy swampland, you know, in Florida, particularly for a city like Sarasota that is built out. We don't really have green lands where we can continue to develop, and I think it's all the more incumbent upon us to really mature and evolve to the next stage that we start becoming a much more stable community, that we're not so susceptible to these types of financial waves that rock the world.
Well, and I hear different voices, and I'm sure you hear probably more than two voices. Some are very excited and want to see the city growth and city grow, and some maybe want us to kind of remain a small town. Are you somewhere in the middle of that?
Maybe that's an identity crisis, but it's embodied in the logo of the city. It's a small town with great urban amenities is the logo that you'll see on our letterhead and in City Hall. And I think that's kind of been the way Sarasota has been probably since the time of Gillespie and John Ringling, when they drew people here of high wealth and with the promise of what Ringling did here with creating St. Armand's, founding his art museum and trying to draw people here. And so I think certainly we have tools that were put in place before I got to the commission, like our downtown master plan, that do a good job at planning and balancing for both, that you can have a very vibrant downtown core, but it's built to a human scale that is very, that you're not becoming a Fort Lauderdale or a Miami. You're remaining Sarasota, true to your identity, but still have that opportunity for growth that allows for hopefully a diverse mix of young and old, retired and active professionals that are hopefully earning a median wage that is, you know, much higher than where we are right now in this community. And I think that's kind of what we're striving for. So there's definitely, I think, room for growth, and there's room for certainly, I think all of us would agree, a redirection, if you will, and where we want to take what our growth industries are, and not necessarily look again as to tourism and construction as the saviors for our local community, but to hopefully areas such as renewable energy, capitalizing on the presence of our universities locally, particularly Ringling College of Art and Design, to draw some of these types of higher paying jobs into the area that take advantage of that type of workforce.
Kelly, now you represent District 3 in Sarasota, but you seem to have a great concern, and a particular concern for the residents of District 1, which is primarily African American. Explain your great concern for District 1.
Yeah, I grew up in the Indian Beach neighborhood, which is literally right across the trail from Martin Luther King Way, that when I was growing up was 27th Street. Most of my childhood then was playing in youth sports, primarily in that area, particularly Ringling Redskins. One of the things, certainly when I was running for office and campaigning on, was how incredible it was that we went through that 4 or 5 year boom, speculative boom, with so much going on, particularly our downtown, other areas of the community across all of Sarasota County, and nothing was going on in North Sarasota. Particularly Newtown, and that was the case for, you know, probably three decades. And the 2000 census, there was a statement that the city of Sarasota was in the top 10 of most segregated communities in the country. And I don't care what district you represent, as anyone who sits at that table, particularly our city commission, to try to cast a blind eye to that, you put blinders over any future possible holistic development of this city. And so we have very serious issues that have been going on for the past three decades. If you talk to people in Newtown, and obviously you do, and you see it every day in your church, but people say we've lost two generations of young black men pretty much within Newtown, and they're kind of afloat, and that's part of the wave of drugs and the introduction of crack in the 80s, among other things. And it's really time for us as a community to stop the bleeding. And I think that I've fought and continue to represent the interests of my district. My district's boat will rise as District's One boat rises too. That if there is development, if there's prosperity, if there's greater employment opportunities in District One, then certainly a lot of my constituents who are blue collar workers and in that type of economy too, they will benefit as well. As the community, the tax base improves in District 1, where you see crime going down, it becomes a desirable place to live, to open a business. I think that certainly interplays with the entire city and also District 3.
And Kelly, I know that you have a great concern for North Sarasota and Newtown area. But have you ever encountered any challenges trying to reach out to the Newtown community? You've been greeted with some degree of skepticism or maybe seen as an outsider. Have you had great challenges?
Yeah, and that, I think that's true probably for anywhere you go. And, when I went to Guatemala, in a similar vein, the white guy, I was the first Peace Corps volunteer ever sent to this area, and, certainly looked askance at, and what are his intentions? Does he work for the CIA? Again, they had the history of the Civil War, those were serious questions. And I appreciate the fact that if you have had lingering issues in Newtown for so many years and decades, where we've for whatever reason been not effective in really improving the situation, I can certainly hope and expect and appreciate that there will be a level of skepticism and frustration on residents here that are of good faith and good heart that want to change it. That perhaps it's the same old type of discussion and. And good intentions aren't good enough, and that's something that certainly we have to overcome. But there's the fact that we are recognized as one of the most segregated cities in the country. There's a reason for it. Part of our establishment political system has certainly played a part in that. But there are certainly areas, I'm sure, in our African American mm-hmm. community that have played into that and allow that too. And so, it's a long-winded answer, but the answer is yes. But I think it's certainly something that you can understand, empathize with, and you just have to keep working through it and getting to a level of a much greater communication and cooperation that we can start identifying where it is we want to go, and then touching on the pieces on what we need to do to get there.
Well, and clearly some of the problems in Newtown are very acute and unique. Newtown has a unique set of challenges. And I agree with you, there's probably been some failures on both sides, both from the community and outside of the community. But what do we do now, and how do we begin to get beyond the distrust and the frustrations of the past? And how do we begin to move forward and get beyond where we are?
Sure. When I ran for office, and even back then, I had support from a number of grassroots leaders in Newtown when I was running. They couldn't vote for me, but they were supportive. Some of them helped with my campaign. We reflected on we had unemployment reach 4%. I think at one point it was less than 4% in Sarasota County. And if you talk to an economist, if you're at less than 4%, that's basically anyone who wants a job and goes out to look for it will find it. That said, even with that, there was this little bubble that encompassed, the few square miles of Newtown, where we still, particularly our black male population, 18 to 49 years of age, I think unemployment was 20+%. And there's a number of issues why we have that, but, you know, the question that we asked each other, you know, when we were having these discussions was, when we've had this huge construction boom, when if you look at the history of Sarasota, you know, the whole creation of Newtown and the legacy of that was a base of, you know, employment for those blue-collar jobs. And something happened. There was that transition when we had all these individuals that, particularly from Newtown, that built Siesta Key, built Longboat Key, a lot of the condos you see around this community. What happened in this boom that we weren't getting these people back to work? And so part of, you know, what we have tried to do, particularly in this economy, when all the private sector has, you know, you don't see the cranes up, there is... all of that has left, and the only jobs you see going on right now are in the public sector, the school board, the hospital board, the Sarasota County Commission, City Commission. Is we need to make sure that we're doing everything possible to raise the level of awareness that these major infrastructure projects are going on, and I'll just rattle off a few. The Janie's Gardens public housing complex, the Robert L. Taylor recreational complex, Booker High School within the next year will probably break ground. Ed Smith Stadium, we expect, will be at some point breaking ground on a close to $30 million renovation project. All of these things that are public investment projects, we need to make sure that we particularly are talking in that area of Newtown where now unemployment, I think, is above, if you take that subsection of black males, 18 to 49, probably 30+%. That we are making sure that we're advertising it and we're finding out where is that void, the gap between the skills that people need, what's going on there that we need to address to transition and make sure that they're going to be successful on the job. So there has been a process by the city's Newtown Redevelopment Office, and they've been working with Jobs Etc. and the Suncoast Workforce Board to make sure that happens. And I have to certainly give credit to the Sarasota Housing Authority and their Board of Commissioners that they had a contractor on that job that was basically bringing in subcontractors from out of state, a lot of them, and I think they had a visit by, you know, federal authorities. A number of the employees there were not legal residents of the United States. To the Housing Authority's credit, they terminated the contract with that contractor, and now they've got in a local contractor, Tandem Construction, that is really going to a number of lengths to ensure that that is not repeated, and as much as they can do to generate local employment will take place there. You know, and ultimately, these public type of projects will not be going on permanently, but if you can bridge this to the better days of a new economy for this community, hopefully that will, you know, be a process where we're going to be giving individuals new skills that once the economy is going to be improving, that they're going to be able to get work in the private sector and continue to improve the livelihood of their family and our greater community.
Kelly, and I use this term, for lack of better words, you're certainly, I don't, as an outsider, standing on the outside of the Newtown community, and obviously we both acknowledge that some of the segregation in our city is institutional, and certainly I don't think any of us are proud of the distinction of being one of the most segregated cities in the country.
No.
But on the outside, what do you think the African-American community has to do to meet the city halfway? How have we failed in some ways?
I've told this joke to a couple of people in Newtown, but go back again to my experience in Guatemala, and perhaps there's a good degree of relevance there because Guatemala has, you know, a kind of stratified, you know, society too, and that you have kind of the old legacy of the Spanish colonialism, and you have a pure Spanish type of a side with what you would expect to be more traditional white culture, perhaps. You then have a mix between the Mayan and the Spanish that obviously has been going on for centuries, and that would be Ladinos, which, you know, probably no longer maintain any of the Mayan customs, and they speak all Spanish. But then you have a large Mayan culture, which have maintained, you know, the cultural dress and their language and everything else. And but the joke in Guatemala is that there, if you go to the market, you'll find a vendor there, and he's got a two buckets of crabs, and there's a bucket of Guatemalan crabs, and there's a bucket of American crabs, and the bucket of American crabs has a lid on it, and the bucket of Guatemalan crabs does not have a lid on it. And, you know, there's a tourist that comes there, and he sees this, and he thinks it's weird. The crabs look pretty much the same way, and, you know, they're both equally vibrant and alive. And the tourist asks the vendor, he says, you know, what's going on here? Why do you have the American crabs with the lid on it, but you don't have to put the lid on the Guatemalan crabs? And the guy says, oh, it's easy. The American crabs, if they leave the bucket, if I take the lid off, they'll be all over the market, and they'll be jumping out of the bucket and going everywhere. The Guatemalan crabs, the first one that puts his leg over the edge, all the rest of the crabs in the bucket grab him and pull him back in. Mm-hmm. And so, if there's one thing that perhaps I've seen, you know, in Newtown, is that sometimes when people are stepping out and being successful, that there's, for whatever reason, you know, rather than celebrate that success or identify what was done to achieve that or celebrate the fact that somebody's getting involved, you know, there's frequently, you'll hear a chorus of skepticism or for whatever reason why the intentions of that individual may or may not be false, more typically false, and that there's another motive to their intention. And I'm sure there's a degree of truth to some of those, but, you know, I think when, you know, there was another analogy that someone said to me about pickup basketball. You know, we're in a game to, you know, particularly in Newtown, when you look at our unemployment figures, when you look at this gap of perhaps 10, 20 years where we've really done a poor job of ensuring, particularly for young black males, that we're capturing them and giving them the messages, the education, and the opportunities to succeed in life, that we failed at that for 10 to 20 years, particularly in the city of Sarasota, and then including Sarasota County when you look at Greater Newtown, that, you know, we're in a pickup game to save lives and save souls. And when you're in a pickup game, it doesn't matter who's going to join you on that court. You just say, get in the game and start playing. And everybody brings baggage to what you're going to do there, but we don't have time to worry about that. You know, if you want to get involved, get involved. And I think too often, rather than just allowing and encouraging people to get involved, perhaps there's more of the skepticism and saying, well, he's discredited, she's discredited because of X, Y, Z.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I think attitudes, and of course, are formed over a long period of time. And I think the collective mindset of any community doesn't happen overnight. There's True. Probably some cause to it. And I guess if you have been left out for a period of time, you may develop some type of complex. And I believe that's not just Sarasota, the African Americans in Sarasota, but probably African Americans in this country in particular. Do you think that the broader community and government is making the steps now? Do you think there's a climate now to make the steps to help us get beyond that now? Do you think the conditions are right now for us to finally get past our long history, our not-so-good history?
Well, I mean, and you said that this is beyond Sarasotans, African-American communities across the country. That there was a report on NPR last week that said that they did a survey of African-Americans and for the first time in, I don't know how many decades, maybe it's the first time ever, the outlook of African-American families is one that of their children will be better than what they have had today. And that was, according to the NPR story, almost that the American dream has now been translated for once into something that is actually viable and real for the African-American family, if you look at the poll numbers. So, and I'd like to think that that's true for our community, too. I think, you know, certainly with a lot of the investment that's going on in the Newtown area, if you look at the change that's taken place in phase one of converting Janie Poe to Janie's Gardens, and obviously something that was really a blight that they did a documentary on about the tragic living conditions of people in our community, where you have literally some of America's most wealthy living a few miles away, and the conditions that were present there in Janie Poe that finally have been addressed. Phase two is about to start, I think, in a few weeks, where they'll raise the rest of those units. I think that alone is a visible sign for many people, particularly the residents of Newtown, that this is a community that, you know, together, collectively, is going to start, you know, saying enough's enough, and we're changing that reality. And so Eric Robinson's here, and we're going to talk about the national level of embracing change and perhaps Obama's platform on that. And I think it was certainly a powerful message that has resonated far and wide in this country, but it you know, perhaps what you see in that national poll on the way African-American families feel, there might be some of that being translated to a local level in the sense of empowerment that indeed you can participate in this change, and that we have all the tools we need to make sure that, you know, the future of our children as adults will be better than what we're living right now. And so it's certainly a large task for us, and to be successful, and maybe this is what you were getting at too, it's going to take a lot more than the white District 3 commissioner to do it, but to be honest, it's going to take that local leadership from within Newtown that are, you know, perhaps recognizing that each of us carry, and each of these individuals carry their faults and past with them, but if there is the collective desire to change that reality and you accept that, you share that desire, that hopefully we'll arrive at the same destination at some point soon.
Kelly, I don't know if you have what your political aspirations are, but whenever your tenure's up as city commissioner, what do you want your legacy to be? What do you want it to be said about you?
You know, that similar in a sports analogy, that you don't leave anything left on the floor, that you've given it your all, and that you had the opportunity to be an activist in the community and use that position that citizens had entrusted you to have and hold as an elected official, to address some of these issues of perhaps injustice, address issues of inequity in where we've allocated resources, and to ultimately improve the outlook and quality of life for citizens. So, you know, hopefully that would be the legacy, and when they have other commissioners that would follow me, particularly in District 3, but elsewhere, that's what, you know, if they say that people would want the same, then hopefully that would be the legacy, and that they would commit to the same.
Great. You're listening to WSLR LPFM 96.5 Sarasota, Florida, and you're listening to Perspectives with Reverend Kelvin Lumpkin. The Sarasota County Health Department is offering free H1N1 flu vaccines to local businesses. Health Department nurses will travel anywhere in Sarasota County to dispense free vaccines for groups of 20 or more. Families and children are welcome. Although local incidents of flu illness have subsided, another wave of flu illness could cause excessive employee absenteeism and disrupt workplace operations and productivity. Business organizations should get their employees vaccinated and continue to follow precautions of frequent hand washing, covering coughs and sneezing into the inside of the elbow, and staying home when sick. These important actions can help reduce flu illness in the community. To book a free H1N1 clinic at a business site, contact the Sarasota County Health Department at 861-2678. For complete updates about H1N1 flu, visit sarasotahealth.org. Also, the U.S. Census Bureau is hiring in Sarasota and Manatee counties for the 2010 census. These temporary part-time jobs offer good pay, flexible hours, and the chance to work close at home. For more information, call 1-866-861-2010. That's again 1-866-861-2010, or visit them on the web at www.2010censusjobs.gov. Great. Joining us in the show is Mr. Eric Robinson, who is a former chairman of the Republican Party of Sarasota County. He's a political commentator and a political consultant. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Of course, we know a couple of weeks ago there was a 7.0 magnitude earthquake in the country of Haiti, but there was also a great political earthquake in the United States, specifically in Massachusetts. Of course, as we know, last week, Senator Republican Scott Brown won the Senate seat that's been held by Ted Kennedy for nearly half a century, and the political world is still feeling the aftershocks from that race. Do you think President Obama should take Scott Brown's election personally? Was that race a referendum on the politics of our president?
Most definitely. It was a referendum. It was. It's almost sad that it had to occur. I know a lot of Republicans, and me included, rejoiced when it occurred, but we weren't. It was because it allowed the stopping of some of the things that were occurring up until that point. For example, Ted Kennedy negotiated and went with George Bush for No Child Left Behind. They reached across the aisle. They did a compromise, but Barack Obama wasn't doing that. He was ramming through his health care, ramming through his agenda, and there was no way for anybody to say stop. Whoa, let's look at this. Why don't we have the bill before we vote on it? Why don't we look at the bill? And people were upset with that. And the only way in which to do that was to, you know, get the 41st vote. And once they were able to get that, you thought, well, okay, well, maybe they will sit down at the table. Maybe they will compromise. Maybe they will, you know, look at some of the issues that the Republicans' concerns were. Instead, they said, nope, the deal is dead. And that was very troubling for me. This morning, White House Press Secretary Gibbs came out and said that Obama said that he made mistakes. He made mistakes by doing the Louisiana Purchase, by giving all that money to Louisiana to get their vote. They made a mistake by doing the Cornhusker kickback, by exempting just the state of Nebraska from the Medicare increases, which causes states like Florida to have to pay more. Those things were mistakes before Scott Brown became elected. It only because he got elected that people are reexamining and reflected on that. So I'm happy that Scott Brown got elected, but I think it's a sad state of the affairs that it takes that for people to say, you know, hey, maybe we weren't doing this correctly.
Well, now, of course, Massachusetts is arguably the most liberal state in the union, and it's not easy treading for a Republican. And for him to win that race, for Scott Brown to win the race, especially held by the liberal line, Ted Kennedy, says a lot. Now, do you think that his election is an anomaly, or that it's going to start a trend around the country for Republicans?
No, most definitely that the midterm elections are probably going to tick towards us and go against the Democrats. Clearly, it's not just about health care, because Massachusetts already has universal health care. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was the issue of health care. I think it was more the issue of the process that was going on. And Barack Obama is even recognizing it, because all of a sudden, what? Now he's talking about jobs and the economy. For the past year, where has he been on the issue? It's all been about, you know, health care, and ramming it down people's throats, no compromises. I don't know, I'm a little bit of junkie, so I watched the, you know, the Senate hearings on the issues, and it was almost comical when the Republican senators were putting bills together, putting amendments onto the health care bills. So, like, for example, one of them was, why don't you let us have the bill 72 hours before you have to vote on it? And they said, nope. It seems like a very logical thing. They said, well, let's follow Barack Obama and not have any of the taxes in the health care bill apply to anybody below $250,000. No. I mean, no discussion, no vetting. It was very scary. And I think a lot of people saw that. A lot of people upset about the process. I mean, our entire government is based upon checks and balances. And when you take those away, and I'll even say it, Republicans or Democrats, I mean, it doesn't make for good government. The checks and balances are there for a reason.
Well, let me ask you this, Eric. And, of course, with the president and the one party controlling both houses of Congress, do you think the Democrats are maybe doing the same thing that Republicans did when George W. was president and the Republicans controlled both houses?
Well, no, because I'll go back to No Child Left Behind, which is a very controversial bill, far-reaching, like health care, where it affects, you know, all of our children in the school. George Bush did not ram that through. George Bush reached over the line to Ted Kennedy to formulate a compromise. And that's a very controversial, to this day, FCAT, still a very controversial legislation, but it's one that was embraced by the Republicans and the Democrats. Another example, when George Bush went, another controversial thing, he went to Congress to ask for War Powers Act, to exercise his authority in the War Powers Act. He actually got Hillary Clinton to vote with him. If that's not reaching across the line to get Hillary Clinton to vote with George Bush, I don't know what is. So those are two main examples, very controversial agenda items that pretty much shaped George Bush's presidency I mean, if you look at the milestones in George Bush, you look at the war and No Child Left Behind, both of them involved great compromises and transparency with Democrats.
Well, now, Eric, you suggested that Scott Brown's election wasn't so much about health care because Massachusetts already has universal health care. But clearly his election is going to affect the health care debate in Washington. And do you think that Scott Brown's election was enough to actually help derail the president's health care plan?
Apparently it is. I mean, the president has said that. Many Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid has commented about it being dead. I don't still quite understand. Why don't they go back to the table and look at some of the things where there are agreement on both sides? For example, the Republican Party agrees that insurances should be able to compete across state lines. Okay, that's something that both parties agree on. Why don't they work towards working on things that they have mutual agreement on? That's the interesting thing. There are congressmen in the state of Florida that are Democrat that will not be congressman. You know, a year from now, in District 24, and Susan Cosimo, she's a Democrat. She won't be a congresswoman there, and that's why you're seeing a lot of Democrats retiring early, stepping down, because they realize that the time is short. You have congressmen switching parties in Alabama, so I think that they're starting to see the writing on the wall.
So, and because of Scott Brown's election, there seems to be a lot of finger pointing in the Democratic Party. Do you think the Republicans are going to seize this opportunity and make a major dent?
I sincerely hope so. The Republican Party is having a little bit of identity crisis. We're trying to figure out how to work with the new insurgents, particularly the Tea Party, how to utilize that energy and drive within the existing structure that we have. That's creating some issues here locally, which we saw with the school tax referendum, how the Republican Party handled that. But I think that if we can channel that energy correctly, I think that that's going to help the Republicans and ultimately help the country.
Of course, tonight is President Obama's State of the Union address, and of course this is the time when the president outlines his national agenda and his national priorities. But every president boasts a little bit about their accomplishments in the previous year. What can President Obama boast about tonight?
He got a Grammy, and he's won the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, even though he sent more troops to Afghanistan. I think that's his two major accomplishments. Oh, and he gave away Chrysler to the unions against the bondholders. That was another accomplishment that he did.
But Eric, now a lot of Republicans applauded President Obama for sending more troops to Afghanistan. Do you disagree with that decision?
Well, I'm just saying. No, obviously I do support that. I was saying that in tongue in cheek, given the fact that he won the Nobel Peace Prize. it's almost humorous that shows you how much enthralled people are with him and not quick to criticize. There are people in the Republican Party who were not happy with George Bush about his spending. There are people in the Republican Party who were not happy about going into Iraq versus Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But it does seem the other side is they're giving Barack Obama a Grammy. They had to create a new category for the Grammy for the spoken word. Giving him the Nobel Peace Prize when the application comes in 2 weeks after he gets inaugurated. I mean, it shows that people, the critical thinking is lacking there, then what about when he has his agenda about health care? What about when he has his agenda about the economy? Are people going to look at it with a critical eye? I would say no.
And
looks like Vice Mayor is biting at the bit.
and of course, the Vice Mayor can chime in any time. Of course, when President Obama came into office, he came in into office in the worst economic time since the Great Depression, and I personally believe that problems so deep can be solved overnight, and the economy seems to be showing some signs of life. Do you think that as a result of President Obama, his stimulus plan, do you think that ultimately is going to put more people back to work and revive our economy, or do you think it's not good for America?
I have not met one single person who got their job. They could say, I got this job because of the stimulus plan. I think a lot of the stimulus money went to local, county, and state governments, so they wouldn't have to cut their budgets. A few stimulus projects are being done here, usually temporary in nature, but for bang for the buck, for the $700 billion, I just don't see it. I mean, it's a natural process. Well, the country was eventually going to recover. But it is interesting that his State of the Union, listen to his State of the Union, and you're going to hear him talk about agenda items that before Scott Brown weren't even on the table. He's going to be talking about tax cuts. You can have a Democrat, he's going to be opening up the playbook of the Republican Party because he knows that that's what works. He's going to be talking about tax cuts. He's going to be talking about economy. He's going to be talking about the jobs.
So maybe just to jump in there, there's a lot of pieces to jump in on. I'll readily cede to Eric that he probably follows national politics a lot more than I do because that's obviously not my realm. But, you know, there's a few things that I take exception with, the fact that tax cuts, particularly what I believe Obama's going to present in his State of the Union for middle-class tax cuts and small business owners, that was part of his platform and what he spoke to many, many times on the campaign trail. So I don't think that that's something as a result of Scott Brown getting into office. You know, the other thing I would point out, too, is that we hear constantly that somehow people aren't critical and they're just enamored and with Obama, yet at the same time, when Scott Brown wins Massachusetts, it is because people are being critical. I guess what's really frustrating about this administration is, and you know, maybe it happens with every administration, but it seems to be particularly that much heightened with this administration. An individual who's only just completed his first year in office, I don't think the administration or the man have even been given a chance. But you know, in one sense, if you listen to some of the radio talk shows, if you watch some of these television programs, the guy's going to turn this country into a socialist country, and you know he's got his hands in everything and he's changing everything. And then at the other, simultaneously though, he's not doing a darn thing. He's stealing the playbook from the Republican Party. What it seems to be is nothing more than character assassination with the goal to again shift the political playbook. And I think if there is a commitment to true, dialogue and true, you know, change to the things that ails us, then I would hope that those types of things begin to change. You know, the only people that are winning right now, to be honest, are our media outlets like the CNBCs and the Fox News that are driving this 24/7 media circle buzz and stirring these things up. And you know, if you really want to look at that Massachusetts race, and I'm sure someone will write about it, and I was looking it up on my BlackBerry now when Eric was speaking, I bet when it's said and done, there will probably be more to be said about the errors that the Coakley campaign made in projecting her image, particularly with very Massachusetts-centric things, particularly how the DNA of people from Massachusetts for politics and sports are intertwined in some of the things that she said about how Scott Brown was stupid to stand outside of Fenway Park shaking hands, or that Curt Schilling was a Yankees fan, and Curt Schilling's obviously the savior for any Massachusetts sports fan.
Well, now, Kelly, let me chime in for a second.
Sure.
Because you said something very interesting, and of course we know the weeks leading up to the actual election, the White House did have some concerns about the way the race was being run. So do you think that maybe it is not an indication of deep problems within the party, or just the way
there's definitely problems, but somehow this to become, you know, the bellwether moment and all of America are opposed to this, I think is really, you know, disingenuous and ridiculous. I talked to a young lady this past week, lives right here on Central Coconut, was between jobs, did not have health insurance. During that period of time, she was going through her menstrual cycle. She's 29 years old, developed a lump in her breast, had it checked out. It was nothing. It was just related to the period. When she went to get insurance on her own, they obviously request every single piece of documentable information of your medical past. They've exempted her left breast because she had a lump that just appeared during a menstrual cycle. It was nothing. It was a normal issue. And now she's 29, but she's scared as heck that something will happen in the future with this. And she's an artist. She won't be on any corporate plan that'll cover her. And, you know, these are but one of many of 30 million plus vignettes that everyday Americans are living in fear that, you know, their time's going to be up, something's going to happen, they're going to have cancer, they're going to have a lump, they're going to break their leg or whatever else. And rather than have a sense of urgency, and maybe Eric agrees with me that, you know, that there probably are these incremental areas that they need to start doing rather than, you know, hitting the home run out of the park and addressing our healthcare situation. But we have a dire situation for, you know, perhaps getting to be a quarter of the population of this country. And all we have is two parties that are sitting there in a, you know, circular firing squad shooting at each other, and it's not getting us anywhere, and the only people that are winning is the media cycle.
Let me ask you this, and this may lend to something that Eric said. Some are accusing President Obama of stealing plays from the Republican playbook, and apparently one of the things he's going to present tonight is a freeze on spending. Kelly, does that kind of sound like a play on the Republican playbook?
But I also want to say, during the campaign, when asked if he was going to freeze spending, he said no. During the campaign, when he talked about joint conferences, he said there will be transparencies. I will have them advertised on C-SPAN. Didn't happen. People see that. And to blame the messenger, CNBC, to blame Fox News, to blame the people saying, wait a minute here. Look at what he said and look at what he does. And to say that that's the messenger's fault for pointing out the dichotomy between those two, I don't think it's the messenger's fault. It's the messenger. You know, don't tell us, you know, that you're going to do one thing and then do another thing. When I say he's stealing a play out of the playbook of the Republican Party, what I'm saying is I don't think he actually believes these things. He just knows this is where he needs to go as a politician to distract people, to bring people back towards himself.
So you suggest
I don't think Barack Obama is a strong supply-side economic. I don't believe he believes in tax cuts to stimulate the economy. I think in his heart of hearts, I don't think that that's what Barack Obama's at.
So you're saying Barack Obama's being a politician and not being governed by his convictions.
Right. And for example, the freeze is only on a very small part of the economy, and I'm curious how that's going to actually work. Does that mean the employees who work in those departments aren't going to get pay raises for those 3 years period of time? Is that what that means? That these people who go to work every day, day in and day out, they're going to have to suffer the ills because of the massive overspending by Congress and the executive branch. These people who come in and do their jobs. Congressmen and the president, they have automatic pay raises. What happened? They're not covered under the spending freeze. What happens to the people in those departments that have the spending freezes? Does anybody care? Anybody talking about that?
Now, I want to ask you, and we're running out of time. Time flies when you're having fun. There are voices both in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and notably in the Democratic Party, Governor Bill Richardson, who endorsed Obama very early. Both parties are suggesting, or some in both parties are suggesting, that President Obama has lost the connection and the magic that he had, the connection that he had with the American people. Do both of you agree with that, or do you see that?
I would think that people are starting to realize the difference between campaign rhetoric and governing, and I'm hoping that Obama does too.
I think everybody, including many people locally, when we had, I think the weekend before the inauguration last year, in the Newtown Recreation Center, they hosted an Embrace Change dinner banquet. And, you know, one of the speakers there that evening, and I forget who it was, said that the amount of expectations being thrown upon the back of President Obama was, you know, literally incredible and literally ridiculous. And I think, you know, we are starting to appreciate the fact that those were never there, and whether that was campaign rhetoric or not, I'm not sure if these were ever promises made by Obama or people on the campaign. But I agree that, you know, governing is difficult, particularly the way that it works. You know, the other side of it is that I don't think George Bush, and Eric can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think he ever had a filibuster-proof majority in Congress, but certainly the Bush administration got a lot of things through Congress. And I would expect that Obama will be able to continue to do that without a filibuster-proof majority.
Well, Eric, let me ask you this question, and this, I'm alluding to what Commissioner Kirchner said. Of course, Barack Obama came into office and inherited two wars, a terrible economy. Do you think that the expectations are realistic of the president?
Yes, but the person who created the expectation was Barack Obama. He's the one who went to Colorado with the Greek columns. He's the one who became a cult of personality. He's the one who took the Grammy. He's the one who got the Nobel Peace Prize. To say that he was just caught up and unaware of the situation and the hysteria that swept him into office is disingenuous. I mean, he was the direct benefactor, and clearly he knew. He was part of the strategy to somehow say that he wasn't aware of what was going on or he had no input in what was going on. It says more about Barack Obama than it does about the campaign. I mean, they made a conscious decision to speak towards change, to have these grandiose ideas, and then when they came in, not so much.
Well, now speaking of the Nobel Peace Prize, of course, there are some who think that the president does not have enough body of work to deserve the Nobel Peace Prize, and then there are some who feel that he does deserve it because
George Bush. Neither am I.
Well, for that reason as well, but some feel that he has changed the world's perception of the United States and even the way the United States approaches the world. And I want both of you to chime in on this. Do you think he deserves it or doesn't deserve the Nobel Peace Prize?
He got the applications were due on the 1st of February, okay? That was all based upon the campaign rhetoric. He hadn't traveled to the Middle East yet. He hadn't gave his speech in Cairo yet. Those things had not occurred. I think he got the prize because a lot of people in the world were upset with George Bush and simply because he wasn't George Bush. And that devalues the Nobel Peace Prize. That's not the reason why people should get the Nobel Peace Prize. It isn't because of who they're not. You should get the Nobel Peace Prize because of what you've done.
Well, Calvin, I think it's a decision for the committee that decides who gets the Nobel Peace Prize, and if they're going to erode the brand and the legitimacy of the prize by virtue of it, we'll see if that happens. But, you know, it's a interesting and fun debate, but certainly that, you know, you can address and look at polls throughout the world, and as Eric said, maybe it was anybody but George Bush would have done the same thing, and we can debate this till the cows come home, but that's ultimately their decision in Oslo.
But it would have shown true leadership if Barack Obama said, no, I think there's somebody else more deserving. That would have shown true leadership. And if you were to pick somebody else from outside the United States, that I think would accrue to the benefit of Barack Obama and to the world.
And I think most Americans are going to look to Obama for leadership on deciding what we're going to do with Pakistan, how we're going to manage Afghanistan, and not necessarily on whether or not he travels to receive a prize or not.
Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It's been a pleasure having both of you, and I hope this won't be the last time you come on. Radio Dave is up next. Again, you're listening to WSLR LPFM 96.5, Sarasota. And this was Perspectives with Reverend Kelvin Lumpkin. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks.